Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Wake up to something different on Sunday mornings by joining me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz. The finest in modern jazz, from hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz every Sunday morning at 9 on Sheffield Live. 93.2 FM.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3, here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk, and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning, welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there, you can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. You've got Julian Pulley live in the studio, of course, as usual. Paternoster Row in the workstation in Sheffield, if you know where that is. Later in this hour, we'll be talking to RPG. We normally have guest speakers every week, but our Chris can't be with us this week. He's a guest speaker, regular guest speaker for the fourth Saturday of the month. But if you're tuning in next Saturday, which is Easter Saturday, so Easter Bank Holiday coming up, we will still be here. All being well, we should have Phil Muffet on the line, Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society. He's our regular speaker for the first Saturday of the month. He'll be covering the Eye on the Sky, club news, loads more besides adventures with his telescope. Fascinating stuff. Before we move on to an amazing article or story about helium, Paul's going to remind us of a few things.
Yes, if you go to the website Smartphone Free Childhood, and where you can sign the Parent Pact online and join parents in your area who are delaying smartphones and social media. That's www.smartphonefreechildhood.com.
Worth saying that Austria, I think, have just decided to ban social media for under 14s, coming soon to a place near us. Should apply to adults as well, if you ask me, but there you go.
And a lovely reminder for you tomorrow, it's clocks forward, or as they say, march forward. So BST starts tomorrow, Sunday, 29th of March, 2026. So the clocks march forward plus 1 hour at 2 a.m.
Excellent.
And finally, you've got What? How many more days?
Oh, today or tomorrow to go and see the most marvellous Sheffield Photographic Society annual exhibition at Sheffield Cathedral.
Yes, if you're going through the main entrance and go over to your right, it's all over there in the corner. Brilliant, lots to look at. And you can actually vote for one if you want.
There's you can indeed.
Lots of different subjects to look at.
And if you tune into this show regularly, of course, you'll know that our guest speaker for every third Saturday of the month is Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and also ex-president of Sheffield Photographic Society. I think he's got about six or seven prints in this year's exhibition. All exciting stuff.
So that's the Sheffield Photographic Society Annual Exhibition 2026 at Sheffield Cathedral. It finishes...
We think Monday afternoon probably start taking it down. So you've got today and tomorrow.
Or you can go to their website, sheffieldphotosociety.org.uk, or find them on Facebook and Instagram.
Great stuff. Next up, it's a great article I saw in the Sunday Times on the 15th of March. So it's a couple of weeks ago now. It's about helium. And it was written by, the article was written by Olivia Sergai, and she was talking about it's the coolest of all gases, and its role is vital in our lives, from hospitals to phones. I thought this was an absolute cracker of an article. So most people associate helium with squeaky voices and birthday balloons, but in reality it is one of modern industry's most quietly indispensable elements. And healthcare is one of its biggest users. Helium is used for cooling the magnet inside magnetic resonance imaging or MRI scanners. In the year to March 2024, the National Health Service performed more than 4 million MRI scans, which help diagnose issues such as tumours and torn ligaments. Liquid helium, which has a boiling point, get this, of minus 269 degrees Celsius, is the only material cold enough to get rid of electrical resistance in metals, allowing them to maintain stable magnetic fields. Most MRI scanners use about 2,000 litres of liquid helium a year. However, MRI scanners are far from the only technology dependent on helium's remarkable cooling abilities. Next up is semiconductors. The first one's MRI scans, but helium's also used in semiconductors, vital to the digital economy. Helium gas plays a crucial role in the manufacture of semiconductors, the microchips found in everything from cars to smartphones, as well as fibre optic cables that carry internet traffic. And because helium is inert, and that means it does not chemically react with other elements, it is used to create ultra-clean environments for chip production. It's also effective at transferring heat away from components as they are built. Without temperature control, materials can expand and distort, ruining electrical pathways. In fibre optic production, helium stops air bubbles getting stuck in the fibres, which could lead to signal loss. The other one, rocket launchers. So when Katy Perry went to space on Blue Origin's new Shepard rocket last April, helium played a crucial part in her journey. During rocket launches, whether operated by NASA or private firms such as SpaceX, helium is used to pressurise fuel tanks, purge propulsion systems and help push fuel into engines as rockets climb through the atmosphere. A single launch typically uses about 1 million cubic feet of helium. So NASA also uses helium to support the International Space Station for rocket launches, with the gas helping to clean rocket engines and keep components working safely during launch. The appeal is simple. Helium is inert and non-flammable, meaning it will not react with volatile rocket fuels, even in extreme heat. Who knew all this about helium? It's just a brilliant article. Next, scientific laboratories. Some of the coldest places on Earth are laboratories. Facilities such as the Large Hadron Collider on the French-Swiss border rely heavily on liquid helium to operate. At extremely low temperatures, materials behave in unusual ways that allow physicists to study quantum effects and fundamental particles. Even near absolute zero, atoms still move, but cooling them with liquid helium dramatically slows that motion, allowing scientists to observe phenomena that would otherwise be obscured by thermal energy. So the Large Hadron Collider's superconducting magnets, for example, are cooled with liquid helium so they can guide particle beams with extraordinary precision. And finally, leak detection. Helium is also used because of its size. As one of the smallest atoms in the periodic table, it can escape through openings too small for almost any other gas. That makes it ideal for leak detection in high-precision manufacturing and safety testing, where engineers introduce helium around sealed equipment and use sensitive detectors to identify if any gas passes through microscopic gaps. And because helium is inert, non-toxic and present only in trace amounts in the atmosphere, which is about 0.0005% of the air we breathe, even tiny leaks can be detected with high accuracy. This technique is used to test everything from fire extinguishers and refrigeration systems to medical devices and high-pressure vacuum sealers that are used in power plants. So that's a tremendous article that was in the Sunday Times a couple of weeks ago. The coolest of all gases, helium, and that was an article by Olivia Sergai. Fantastic.
I could have loved you good like a planet. I could have changed your heart to a star. But it really doesn't matter at all. No, it really doesn't matter at all. Life's a guide. I could have built a house on the ocean. I could have placed our love in the sky. But it all really doesn't matter at all. No, it all really doesn't matter at all. Life's a guise. I could have turned you into a priestess. I could have burned your feet in the sand. But it all really doesn't matter at all. No, it all really doesn't matter at all. Life's a guess. But it all really doesn't matter at all. No, it all really doesn't matter at all. Life's a guess. I hope it's gonna last.
What a great track there. Yes. Life's a Gas, T-Rex, from their amazing 1971 album Electric Warrior. Right. See, who says science is boring? We play some amazing tracks on this show. Any excuse, really. You are, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms, live in the studio every Saturday morning, 11 until 12. Next up, I know RPG, when we speak to him later on, is going to be talking about bees. But I saw this very short article in the press. Bee alert. Watch out for low-flying bumblebees. Only the queens from a bumblebee colony survive the winter by burying themselves in soil or leaf litter. The rest die. And it's amazing because around where we live, we've seen a couple of massive bumblebees.
Yes,
and they're solitary at the minute.
One came in the kitchen.
Oh, yeah, couldn't get rid of it. But we did get it back outside.
We did.
So I never knew that, but the mated queens emerge in spring getting an early start to find nesting sites. They can fly in air as cool as 10 degrees Celsius, but they need a body temperature of 30 degrees Celsius to do so. To warm up, they temporarily dislocate their wings from their flight muscles. Ooh. Then shiver those muscles up to the right temperature. Flying low, they head straight for the rare nectar and pollen of early spring flowers. The sight of one bumblebee will probably lead to spotting another. So that's a fascinating fact about bumblebees. Only the queens from a bumblebee colony survive the winter. The rest die. Wow.
Right. This is all about a company called Cubatech, which is Q-U-B-E-R-T-E-C-H, Cubatech. A British biotech firm aims to be the first in the world to create a sustainable alternative to natural rubber with latex harvested from dandelions. By producing products that range from wetsuits to condoms, Cubatech hopes to ease the reliance on the rubber tree, which is threatened by climate change and disease. The latest gene editing techniques will be used to grow larger dandelion roots for a greater yield.
Amazing. Oh. If you tuned in the other week, we were talking about mycelia leather, where a lot of fashion companies now are making leather from mushrooms. It's amazing, isn't it? I think our PG will like this next story. First electric flight takes mail to Scottish Islands. So, Europe's first electric aircraft took off from Glasgow on the 20th of March, heading to Orkney, several hundred miles away. The battery-powered aircraft was used by Royal Mail to deliver post to remote parts of Scotland, landing in Dundee and Inverness before flying to Kirkwall Airport. The Allier CX300, developed by the American manufacturer Beta Technologies, has a range of about 300 miles from battery packs that take an hour to charge and can carry 560 kilograms of letters and parcels. Wow. The flights are designed to show how electric aircraft could be integrated into Royal Mail's network without disruption. Royal Mail aims to halve its use of regular domestic flights as part of its net zero by 2040 strategy. The single pilot aircraft is in its testing phase and will need approval by the Civil Aviation Authority, or CAA. The programme will look at the ability of aircraft to transport mail and essential goods such as medical supplies, providing data on range, turnaround times and reliability. Chris Paxton of Royal Mail said this is an important step towards making electric mail flights a reality for some of the UK's most remote communities. It's a glimpse of the future. He said sustainable transport could one day form every part of the transfer of letters and parcels to remote areas. Luke Farajala of Loganair, which operated the flight, said it was a landmark day for European aviation. Amazing.
Right, this is a very short story, but wow.
It's an interesting one, isn't
this
it?
This is all about lab-grown
esophagus.
Yes. What is it going on with at the beginning? An esophagus has been grown in a laboratory for the first time, meaning that within 5 years, children born with part missing could have a new organ grown using pig tissue and their own cells. Researchers at Great Ormond Street and University College London transplanted the lab-grown organs into pigs, which were able to swallow normally.
Amazing. And this other story made me smile to myself. We see you, gull. Seagulls stealing your chips can put a dampener on a day at the coast. But scientists at the University of Exeter found that sticking googly eyes on food cartons was a deterrent. In field experiments in Cornwall, gulls proved wary of boxes with eyes, confirming why many insects, amphibians and fish have eye-like markings to ward off predators. Who knew, eh? Ooh. So put some goggly eyes on your food, on your chips.
We've seen it at Bridlington, haven't we?
Yeah. Vicious. And finally, from a roundup of sort of stuff that's been in the news, science news this week, developers will be required to install solar panels and heat pumps in all new homes in England as part of updated planning requirements published by the government on Tuesday. Plug-in solar panels that homeowners can self-install on balconies would also be available in supermarkets in the coming months. Such things have been available across Europe for a long time now, but there's been safety concerns which the government are I think, are close to solving. So they'll be popping up on Lidl and Aldi, places like that. It's for people, it's so you can just fit them without any upfront sort of infrastructure and stuff. So it's interesting. But for the last decade, successive governments have been trying to develop the Future Home Standard, which is an update to the way that new homes have to be designed in England. And the new guidance means that from 2028, no new homes will be on the gas network. So anything built from 2028, no new homes will be on the gas network and will instead be on a heat network or get a heat pump. And they must have solar panels on their roof, covering an area equivalent to 40% of the ground space. Interesting stuff.
Don't judge, offer your love. Don't make promises to the world. Keep them to yourself.
Nice, that RPG loved that.
Yeah, that was a track called Free as the Morning Sun from 1979, and that was Diva Dip, or in brackets, Carlos Santana.
In brackets, Carlos Santana. But of course, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Next up, how does what you eat affect your health? Let's talk about pastries. Ooh, grabbing a croissant for breakfast or a Danish pastry or cinnamon bun with your coffee is a habit that is worth quitting. A recent study from the University of Oxford presented at the European Society of Cardiology Congress found that eating a buttery pastry every day could silently elevate the risk of severe heart issues within just 4 weeks. Pastries are possibly one of the worst offenders in our diets. Beneath their flaky layers and sweet fillings lurk a variety of health risks. Pastries often contain damaging fats, including trans fats and harmful byproducts such as peroxides, which are as a result of high temperature baking or frying. These contribute to inflammation and oxidative oxidative stress in the body, disrupting cell membranes, and according to a study published in the Journal of the American College of Nutrition, increasing cardiovascular disease risk factors such as elevated bad cholesterol, or LDL, and hypertension, which means blood pressure, high blood pressure. So pastries are typically high in other harmful compounds called advanced glycation end products, or AGEs for short, that form when sugar binds to proteins or fats during baking. These advanced glycation end products, or AGEs, can promote oxidative stress and inflammation, contributing to cellular aging as well as chronic health conditions such as diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and kidney disease. Pastries contain 10 to 50 times more of these nasty compounds than less processed foods like fruit and vegetables and whole grains, so we should eat them very sparingly, if at all. So if your thing in the morning is a flaky pastry, a croissant or something like that, you better think again. And on a similar note, processed spreads, oh my. Britons consume 120 million kilograms of spreads each year, including many plant-based options such as those made from sunflower, olive or other oils. In the UK, these spreads are no longer manufactured using the partial hydrogenation technique that solidified plant oils into spreadable paste, but also created trans fats with unhealthy side effects, especially for the heart. Instead, a method called interestification is often used to transform vegetable oils into spreads. In a review paper on interestified, or i.e. fats, at UCL, researchers at UCL said that's University College London, said that the health effects of those sort of fats are not well understood, but some researchers have suggested they may have adverse effects on cardiovascular disease risk and lipid metabolism. Annoyingly, most plant-based spreads don't specify whether those spreads contain interestified fats, or i.e. fats, as there are no regulations to do so in the UK. But the researchers at UCL found most of those spreads available are made from those nasty fats. Plant spreads, particularly those made with rapeseed or sunflower oil, can also contain high amounts of omega-6 fatty acids. When over-consumed, these can exacerbate inflammation and oxidative damage, potentially harming brain and cardiometabolic health. Any spread containing additives such as preservatives, colouring, flavouring and emulsifiers is classified as an ultra-processed food. And if you like chips, oh, I don't think there's going to be much good news in this one either. We know that they are not health food, but that doesn't diminish our love of chips. About 167 million portions of fish and chips are consumed each year. And figures from Kantar, a market researcher, show that 7.4 million people eat frozen chips once a week. This is not good news for the waistline. Potatoes fried in oil lose some of their water content and absorb fat, which is why a small baked potato contains only 128 calories and 0.18 grams of fat, whilst the same weight of chips provides about 431 calories and 20 grams of fat that will settle as body fat if consumed in excess of your energy needs. So if you eat more energy than your body burns up, then it'll store it as excess fat. So think about maybe having a baked potato. So frying starchy foods such as potatoes also produces relatively high amounts of acrylamide, a toxic chemical found during exposure to high temperature cooking, which some studies have suggested may increase the risk of certain types of cancer. The European Commission classed acrylamide in category 1B as a carcinogen and a mutagen, leading to genetic mutations and DNA damage, and in category 2 as a reproductive toxicant associated with a risk of subfertility. One study of 4,440 people aged between 45 and 79, which was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, found that over an 8-year period, people who ate chips and other types of fried potatoes, such as hash browns, twice a week, doubled their risk of dying prematurely. Frozen oven chips contain less fat, but can be high in sodium, which is used as a preservative and flavour enhancer, and other additives that are not beneficial to health. So if you want to, you really like your chips and your hash browns and stuff, think about having a jacket potato. Way better for you. And apparently once you, if you change your eating habits and you do it for long enough, I think about a year, you won't go back to your old habits. No. You just got to stick with it. And finally, before we contact RPG, breakfast cereals. Ooh. We know that many breakfast cereals are not a healthy choice given their high sugar content, but they remain a morning staple, with 85% of Britons eating them. Most ready-to-eat breakfast cereals are considered ultra-processed foods due to the high level of industrial processing they undergo. Studies on ultra-processed foods, including many ready-to-eat breakfast cereals, show they are linked to higher risk of obesity, metabolic syndrome, and cardiovascular diseases. Many cereals marked as healthy or nutritious may still contain relatively high levels of sugar and additives, and those fortified with vitamins and minerals can still also be high in sugar and low in natural fiber, exacerbating issues such as bloating. Now, highly refined and sweetened cereals lack the fiber needed to support a healthy gut biome, potentially leading to digestive symptoms and reduced metabolic health benefits associated with whole grains. Most breakfast cereals, even the less processed types like muesli or granola, often contain heat-induced contaminants like acrylamide, which we talked about earlier on, and help me with this, trying to say this one, hydroxymethyl furfural, which are linked to DNA damage and other harmful effects on health when consumed in large amounts. So bad news there for pastries and processed spreads and chips and breakfast cereals. So make sure you do a look on the label if you're going to buy or eat any of those products. Fantastic track there. Beth Blade and the Beautiful Disasters, Sin Eater. And that was one of our PG's picks from Glory Days Rock Show, actually, which you can listen to Mondays 1 till 3, from way back in 2022. But, of course, you are listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM, on digital, if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms, every Saturday morning, live in the studio from 11 until 12. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Yes, we have a new lead for the phone-ins. Everything's working marvellously. The sun is shining. Lights are working.
It's a lovely day today.
It is. And we're coming up to Easter. Clock's going forward and Easter's on its way next weekend.
It is, yeah. It costs us an hour in bed, but I suppose it's nice to get there.
It's exactly. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
A few things. One of them is a great article on BBC website from Esme Stallard, who is looking at the news that England's sewage spills nearly halved last year in 2025. But the clincher is that it was because of the better, drier weather. And they say that... The water companies released raw sewage into England's rivers and seas for 48% fewer hours in 2025 compared with the year before. That's according to the Environment Agency. But I think most people, when they dig a little bit deeper into it, find that the regulator confirmed that they think most of the improvement can be put down to the drier weather rather than any infrastructure upgrades, which we all paid more on our bills.
Isn't it?
So sewage is split when it's raining to prevent the system becoming overwhelmed. Sorry, spilt. To stop it pouring out and backing up into people's homes, they say. So with less rain, there are fewer sewage releases. And environmental charities said that the lower numbers were not evidence of a real change. So, and the weather can sort of contribute in ways that we don't always think of. But in 2025, there were 1.9 million hours of sewage spilled compared with 3.6 million the year before. So a great reduction and a windfall by whatever means. But I think the thing that got me was to actually have a look at the list that they published for that year, so that they start off, I think, with Anglian Water, who had a number of sewage spills, and they say they had 16,779, an average duration of 6 hours per spill, so there was pouring out raw sewage for 101,598 hours. And you can see that sort of follows through. You got Northumbrian, but South West Water had 46,164 spills, lasting for an average of 9 hours. That's 407,006 hours. And locally, Yorkshire Water had 51,431 spills, lasting an average of 6 hours. That's 285,931. So it's a tremendous problem still. And, you know, we're being sold upgraded systems through to 2030 and beyond. It just is a real sort of issue. So that's one of the things that caught my eye. And also, just a note on what you were saying earlier about helium. I noted that with the conflict in the Gulf, we also had a strike on the helium liquid gas production, which is based in Qatar.
Yes.
And they're the world's biggest supplier with something like 10 billion cubic metres. So it's an essential thing, apart from the oil, that's being affected by that issue.
The article, that was the reason behind the article, actually, says war disrupts helium production. And they were saying the price of helium has risen sharply since the war broke out in the Middle East due to supply and chain disruption. This article said last year Qatar produced about 63 million cubic metres of helium, accounting for roughly a third of the global supply. But I thought I avoided mentioning the war issue, but I thought the helium scientific aspect of that helium was fascinating.
Yeah, it absolutely. And you say it's so integral in so many things. We don't always know just how much it's involved. So a good thing, and I just thought it's worth mentioning that it became the conflict.
I know.
I guess the other thing that sort of caught my eye was from UK government, and they've put forward the premise that we can move onto smart power, and they're going to back the installation of domestic heat pumps in the home, but also what they call plug-in solar power panels. And it kind of tweaked my sort of thoughts. And I thought, well, okay, so what are we talking about? Because quite often nowadays you'll see roofs with a cluster of solar panels on. And reading into that in the past, that includes the installation of a system in the house to convert that power. The power that's created on your solar panel is a direct current, whereas all the things generally in our homes run on alternating current. So you've got DC current from the solar panel, alternating current required in the house, so you need an object called an inverter, which takes the DC and switches it over to an AC supply. And then they start to say, well, that's fine, well, the sun's shining, but what happens? You know, it becomes supplementary rather than a main sort of contributor. And so there's a need there for a storage system, so they talked about battery systems to back it up. And when you got into those systems, they got to be very expensive for a total installation. So you see in eco-houses, it's a great thing. It's a long-term payback period, but it does sort of either negate your bills or to massively reduce your bills. So plug-in, what was that? And the thing that I read sort of seemed to say in a simplistic way that you plugged your solar panels into a socket and that took it back to the national grid. And it's one of the things that there's little clarity about. So I think if you've been a boater or a caravanner, you'll have come across the small solar panels that you can unfold, put on the roof of a boat or a caravan, and get a supply for electricity from that. Through an inverter, and again, you've got the issue of whether that's available all day or not. So it's an interesting proposal moving forward, and certainly for the heat pumps, there's been a lot of resistance to say that the heat pumps don't provide the level of warmth that we've come to expect from other heating systems. The problem, I think, is that they produce a level amount of heat, typically sort of 19-20 degrees. So it takes the chill off, but it doesn't give you the feeling of direct heat. So interesting development, interesting proposal from government, but it's one of those things where we need a lot of explanation. When you do have the ability to export energy, then you can come under, they've produced what they call the Smart Export Guarantee to get paid for your extra solar energy. Again, you've got the problem that it's exported while the sun's shining and you're producing the electricity, and that, in some instances, will give you about 15 pence a kilowatt hour for that export. If you've got one of the systems with battery backup and you therefore have excess power at other times, you get a different rate. So, a lower rate, by the way. So it's kind of a bit weird, and none of that will happen if you don't have a smart meter installed. So, again, my personal experience with smart meters is I'm on my second. They're pretty useless because I live in an older house. My electricity supply comes in the cellar. And guess what? Smart meters can't talk to the outside world through a pile of earth and stone. Again, I think there's pressure from the government, and British Gas is starting to say to customers, hey, we need to fit you a new smart meter. So a lot of stuff needs sorting out, and it could really, really do with more clarity. It seems to be headline grabbing, but for most Joe public like myself, it's okay. So what is it? What is the system? What can you do? And what they cited was Aldi or Lidl supplying £400 plug-in solar panels as part of this, and they're available from other people. But if you look at the mechanics of it, quite often you need an installation from an energy supplier. And again, if you look at the kind of thing that they installed for putting insulation on houses and the disaster that's happened there, what we don't want is another thing where lots of installation specialists crop up from nowhere. Sort of cash in on a government scheme.
Yeah, so, it's a health and safety issue as well, isn't it?
It is, but it's one of those things, you know, it's a great idea, but it's in the early stages of making, so good luck to anybody who's going to go down that route. It is a long-term objective to give us clean energy, but again, really got to have a look. I mean, the insistence is that they're going to fit the heat pumps and the solar panels, or they're going to introduce legislation to make sure that every new build comes with a heat pump and the solar panels. So that's government doing that. And we go back to where I started out with the sewage systems. One of the things that kind of interested me was to find out that human waste is treated and dried out and then extensively used in farming as a manure fertilizer. And there was an article which we sort of picked up on, which was from Eliza Luku in The Sun on the 23rd of March, and she kicks off by saying thousands of jars of British honey could be contaminated with prescription medicines from cancer drugs, painkillers, antidepressants and antifungals. So scientists tested raw honey samples from a variety of UK locations, finding that all were contaminated with some form of chemical. And again, it's one of those things, you know, grandma told you that honey was good for you. So what we're finding is that the reality of the modern world are that there are more than 100 different contaminants that are emerging as concerns. But medicines for human use were most frequently spotted contaminant in honey. So two-thirds of honey samples had the potential of being some risk to consumers by ingesting the contaminants. And that was research undertaken by University of Leeds and the OK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology in Oxfordshire. So unlike pesticides, for which dietary exposure guidelines exist, there are currently no established regulatory thresholds for most contaminants of emerging concern, or shortened to CECs, in food products, including honey. So I thought I'd spoil things a bit on the honey front.
Oh, no.
Because you spoiled mine because I had fish and chips last night.
Ah, you see. But it's interesting. So is it contamination from the manure that's coming from our waste system, or is it from the water course?
It's coming through growing plants, because obviously they're collecting pollen from the plants that grow. So it's coming from the soil through the plant to the bees, and then the bees are creating the honey. But unfortunately, it can contain contaminants. So there is a sort of thing on water treatment plants that are supposed to try and remove a lot of those contaminants. But obviously, this is going through the process, and surprisingly extensive use of the sort of dried human waste that's going on to the agricultural sites. And obviously in nature, it starts to travel its way through food chains and everything else. So it's at low levels generally at the moment, but as they say, there's no control. A bit like we were talking about the actual sewage outflow. It's supposed to be an emergency procedure, but it far exceeds any expectation that you're expecting that. Although rainfall has grown, and we can see from the cycle that I mentioned earlier that it can dry up and it can change the balance. But overall, it's a growing problem of contamination. So I thought that was very interesting, and it kind of then kicked me into thinking about bees.
Oh.
So I thought, well, okay, I keep seeing bees, and I do sort of see them as an indicator of things like the weather picking up and everything else. But I sort of wondered, well, how long have bees been around? So any guesses?
Oh, a long time.
Yeah.
Well, Egyptian? No?
No, way back. So bees have been around since the Cretaceous period, which is 124 million years ago.
Oh, my words. Okay.
So they were around in the age of the dinosaurs. They were still sharing the planet with that. And they're from winged insects. So they're monophyletic clade of Anthothrys.
Go on, say that again, Paul.
Get your teeth in.
Well, they're in the family of Apodi, which is the order of Hymenoptera, and there are 20,000 known species of bees that come in seven recognised families. So they're thought to evolve from predatory wasps. and they are known to have thrived in desert and shrubland areas, and they were around on what was the supercontinent of West Gondon. Can't read me on down. It split off from Africa to leave South America and Africa apart. And if you want to sort of follow up on that, you can read a Wikipedia article, which is just B-E-E. And the oldest known fossil is from a sample in New Jersey amber. It was found in case, so it was a whole example of a corbiculate bee, and that was from 70 million years ago. So Friends of the Earth UK do a brilliant bee identification guide. So it's friendsoftheearth.uk, and they also can supply a bee saver kit, and that asks for a donation. There's a range that you can put in if you wish to get a bee kit, and research shows that the bees are at risk from contaminants in plants and also from changes, because they seem to be adaptable for the higher temperatures. That seems to be their sort of evolutionary path, was from desert areas, and they still sort of cling to that kind of an environmental level. So the other fun bit before we get to the end of the show was that there was some research done about bees and hummingbirds, and they're saying that they collect pollen, and one of the things that happens with the pollen is there's a side effect that it produces a minute amount of alcohol.
Ah.
So when the bees want a good day out, they can go and collect some pollen and get drunk on bee pollen.
You sometimes, because we're lucky enough to get quite a lot of bees. When we've had wet weather, I mean, bees do suffer, don't they? So that makes sense. That they originally came from a hotter climate type thing. But you see them, they almost overdose on pollen, don't they? And then they're like staggering around.
Yeah, carrying the huge pockets of pollen on the back legs. And so it's very interesting, because I think on different plants I used to see different types of bee, because they're a sort of hive-living bees, which is what a lot of the bumblebees and honeybees are part of. But then there are also a range of what they call solitary bees. And solitary bees don't live in a hive. They tend to find little sort of gaps in walls and places to live. So they live a kind of a different life to that. And again, on that sort of collection for feeding plants, recently scientists have come up with a superfood. So if you've got an alien hive, you can introduce some superfood, and that helps the colony to look after their grubs and the future generations.
Amazing. We once had a solitary bee in our blue tits nest box that it uses every year. The blue tits weren't happy, and for 1 year they were ousted.
Oh, yeah.
And on that note, Paul, we're going to let you go, and we're going to play out a cracking track by Stevie Ray Vaughan. Honeybee.
Ooh,
how cool's that?
I'll buzz off then.
I know. We'll speak to you Monday, Paul. Glory Days Rock Show, 1, 2, 3. Bye-bye.
Looking forward to it. Cheers. Bye.
Time goes away, we kiss, just can't miss.